session number 9590, reel 4.
Duffield, reel 4.
The valley of the river, where the two roads were and the railway track was. Now, in point of fact, it was quite easy to cross this valley. The river itself was a shallow river, and you could cross it. It was only thigh deep in water as you did so. And we had to be rather more circumspect about crossing the roads. We had to watch there was no traffic. There was no civilian traffic because, petrol was in short supply in Italy, so there was nobody rushing about in cars, and anyway, they didn't own many cars. So there was just a few trucks, but there was lots of German military vehicles going up and down the road. So we had to pick suitable moments to cross the road and also to make sure there was nothing on the road as we tried to get across the river. Well, we got across all right. And as we got the other side, we met two young girls who were out on a bicycle ride. And they start blathering away. Women, when they speak Italian, their voice is very musical, but they speak very quickly, so I didn't know what they were talking about, you know. But one of them was asking us if we'd been fishing. But we didn't stop and talk to them because we were too exposed to the road where they were stood, and we didn't want to be seen by anybody, so we just smiled at them and dashed on.
Were you in uniform or in civilian clothes?
I was in uniform then. And it didn't seem to make any difference to the Italians what you're in.
In what way?
Well, the Italians sometimes used to think that you were Germans because of the Air Force blue uniform. But they didn't know what you were. But they didn't seem over curious. They were very happy to find out you were not a German because they did not like the Germans. They hated the Tedeschi, as they call them. Yeah.
What did they hate them for?
Well, it's historical, really. They hate them from all the things in the past, but they didn't like the Germans. You know, to us, Germans are quite nice people, really, the ordinary average German. But to an Italian, they were very overbearing people. Rather like the way people think the Americans are at times. No. They're not really overbearing, it's just that they're unsure of themselves. No. But the Germans can be a bit overbearing. I remember I used to go, when I worked at Rolls-Royce, I'd go to meetings in Germany to do with aircraft engines and aeroplanes, and I used to pull their legs a lot about the war and tell them how many times I'd beat them. But they used to joke and laugh because they're just ordinary people. Yeah.
Did you always find the Italians helped you? Because that's the impression you were given.
Yeah, without exception. I evolved a simple method of finding out where not to go. As you walked along, and if you met a child, which you often did, you just asked them where the local fascists lived, and they would tell you, so you didn't go there. But for the rest of them, they were as welcome as a day and night. Only when you were in areas where there was lots of Germans about, they would be a bit afraid. I've been in a house where the wife was terrified the Germans would come and catch me there and kill her husband, because that's what they would have done. But they would still feed you and welcome you.
Now, I interrupted you with you encountering these girls on bicycles.
That's right, yeah.
Could you take it from there?
Yes, I say we didn't stop and talk to them too long, because where we were was a bit exposed to the road, so we just kept on walking. Now, I'd come to the conclusion, if I wanted to really cover distance, it was no good having a uniform on, because a uniform stands out, it betrays you. There's one little problem: if you take a uniform off and put civilians on and get caught, then you're open to be shot as a spy, as you know. But I weighed things up and I thought, if I keep wearing my uniform, I'll never make it. No. If I can somehow get some clothes, I'll have a more chance. So that next evening I got to a farm and I asked the farmer if he'd swap me some old clothes for my clothes, which he did, and for my maid. So we got some real clothes which would have been probably more suited for a scarecrow now, in my opinion, right, or for my nice uniform, yeah. Which was, you know, good material. He got a good bargain, you see, because it was good hardware and material. He would have to save it for a bit and use it after the war. But he was quite happy, you know. So then I felt safer moving about, which was just as well, because every now and again I used to meet Germans later on, in that sense. And anyway, as we were moving, you know, wandering through the country, I had a system where I used to go and have my breakfast, and they used to make me panaiolo, which is really just bread fried in olive oil, for breakfast, and give me a cup of ersatz coffee, because they had no coffee, but they used to use millets and seed and roast it and make coffee from it. And then I used to stop and have something at lunchtime, and I always used to get an even meal at the farmhouse and also stay there the night. But I'd always, from then on, we kept on moving. Then we met some Italian soldiers, and they'd been up in the north of Italy when Italy had packed in fighting, and then they'd been captured by the Germans and thrown into a prison camp, disarmed and thrown in. But they'd managed to get out of that and were setting forth to go home, and one lived down in Foggia and another lived in Bari down the south, and there's another couple of them with them as well. I forget where they live. And so there was about four of them, and so we walked along with them for a few days, and it was very nice walking along with them, because we used to fare even better in the food sector, because they're the ones that would go in farms and organise food. And but as they could say what they wanted more clearly than we could, you know, we used to get, you know, even better fare, you might say. And they were good fun, they were quite comical, you know. They used to be fascinated that I could tell the time with a compass, an old Boy Scout thing, you know. And but after a while they said, you know, they suggested we ought to separate, because, you know, there was too many of us, which I also thought, you know. So the two of us just continued on then, and we kept on walking. But in the meantime, Cyril Jones was getting a bit tired of all this walking and getting a bit depressed, and we came to one place, and he said he was going to go into this village, and I said you shouldn't go in a village, because in the village this is where the occupying people will be, and the Germans will be there. And he said, well, I'm going to go in that village. I said, well, you can go if you want, Cyril. I said, but I'm not. No. And so he set forth and went into the village, and I just carried on keeping to the fields and the small country tracks. He, as it happened, he went in there, and there were Germans were there and collected him, which I found out later on from some civilians. You know.
So you were now by yourself?
I was now by myself, right on. And then I kept on pushing. Then I met three paratroopers. Now, these three paratroopers had been landed in the south in some operation, and their unit had been surprised and attacked, and they'd got dispersed, and they were now trying to get back down to their own forces, you know. They had no arms. They'd lost them. And there were three of them. And we'd come to a point. We went across a river which was in deep flood, very deep, and there's no way you're going to walk through this, and there was a bridge. And so there was a corporal amongst the person. He went with another one, and he went and did what he called a reconnaissance of this bridge, and he established there was no actual guard on the bridge. And he thought we might be able to get across the bridge, but we'd have to do it separately. So we separated then, and Siddle and I set forth on our own. We went to this bridge, and as we were walking across the bridge, there was an old horse-drawn car pulling across, and the bloke on there shouted us, he knew straight away we were not Italians. He shouted that the Germans were at the other end of the bridge.
Who were you with then?
With Sil, not with Sil. No, sorry, I'm getting mixed up.
One of the paratroopers?
One of the paratroopers, yeah. And he shouted, there was Germans at the other bridge, but I was on the bridge with them. I thought, well, we'll just continue. And then I walked across the bridge and I'm going along the road that led off the bridge, and then a car came by. Well, I knew the only cars that ran were people, were officials. Yeah. And it went by, and then it stopped. And these people were all in civilian clothes, so I knew they were fascists. And they stopped, and well, I said to the other chap, just keep on walking. So we just kept on walking, and then they just drove away. And then at the top of the road, I could see a house, and I could see Germans there. But we just kept on walking, and then we went across the edge and went in the field, and they never saw us. And then climbed up a very steep hill away from the roads. Then when we got to the top of the steep hill, the next thing I saw was British fighter aircraft come wheeling down and whooping off lorries on the road. There was a sort of a little convoy of trucks, and the next minute there was no convoy of trucks. These Tomahawks, the way came and just woofed them off. So I knew we were getting towards where the war was. Yeah. Again.
Do you know roughly where you were geographically?
Yeah, well, what do they call that river? I think it was the River Trento. Hmm?
And what time of the year would this have been?
Well,
winter?
It was late autumn, because it was September when we left the camp. It was December before I got to it. It took me 3 months to get to the south. This would be about November. Yeah.
What happened after the strapping of the trucks?
Well, after certain trucks, the rest of the paratroopers came across. Then those three went off on their own. Now, I know that later on, those three were in a farm where they were surprised by a fascist and held up at pistol point by this fascist. But the corporal jumped him, the fascist, but the fascist shot the corporal and killed him. But the other two managed to escape and get away, because I met the other two later on when we got the other side, because they both got clear in the end. But the corporal died, so his mates got away. But I say, I was then on my own again. And then I kept on walking. And I spent a few days on my own. And the weather was getting atrocious and raining and heavy, and it used to be very hard going in the fields. And one day it was so bad I was walking along a riverbed rather than walking the fields, because it was easier. And then I met a chap getting some water in the river, and he was a New Zealander.
Getting some water in the river?
Water. And he said to me, you know, after he'd said hello, and he says, come and have a cup of tea. And I went over to him, and there was him with another four chaps, all New Zealanders, that had come from a camp at Sulmona, I think it was.
It sounds as though the countryside was alive with Allied troops.
With Allied prisoners, yeah. Yeah, got out of different camps, yeah. It was. So I went up with them and had a cup of tea with them, and they said to me that they always went to a farmhouse for a meal at night, so I went along with them and had a meal there, and I did a lot of chatting with them and drunk. So you always got lots of wine in Italy, and then we came back, and we lived in this little, we were just in a little wood where we were staying, so we stayed the night there again. Then we sat there the next day, sort of a stranger came up to us. He was in point of fact a Yugoslav, and he sat down with us, and we gave him a drink of tea, and he started talking to us, and he couldn't speak English, and he couldn't speak any Italian, but he could speak French. And he was on about that he was going south, and he'd show one of us the way, and he said especially him, meaning me. He says, because he looks like an Italian where you lot don't. And I was insulted to anybody saying I look like an Italian. But nevertheless, I thought about this and I thought, well, I'm going south. And these chaps were no keen to go anywhere, by the way. The three New Zealanders were quite happy where they were. They were waiting, you know. And so, oh, I said, I'll go along with you.
Why did you not wait? And
I realised then that if the British troops had been coming quick, they'd have been long past gone and something had stopped it. No. And I knew about wars, that you have great hopes and sudden big things that don't work out, innit?
So was this Yugoslav an escaped prisoner himself?
No. This Yugoslav was actually a political... Well, he's a political prisoner of the Italians. But he'd been interned in Italy for his politics. He was communist. Eh? And, I think I'm wrong about that. You know that in wartime Yugoslavia, there was the communist resistance to Germany. There was another thing called the Chetniks, no,
yes,
who were not communists. He was one of them. No. Yeah. I got mixed up because there was a number of them in turn, and two of them I knew were out-and-out communists, no, and the others were Chetniks. And one had been a senator in the government in Yugoslavia I met later. Anyway, I wasn't walking. We walked. This bloke was older than me, but he could walk up hills about three times as fast as me. And he had a big pack on his back. And I walked with him and struggled after him. We seemed to walk forever. And eventually we came to a village. And we went in this village, and he'd indicate this is where we'd arrived, you know. And we went into the village, just off a square. We went into a house, and I followed in the house. And as I walked in the house, there sat the table was a German warrant officer. And I thought to myself, oh God, this bloke's done me, you know. But he just said good evening, and we went upstairs, and I followed upstairs. And he lived in a sort of a room upstairs in this house. And this German warrant officer lived down there with the Italian family. He was, you know, billeted in there, because in the village was a German battalion billeted there, in the Italians' houses.
So the German thought he was an Italian?
He thought I was another Italian with him. He just took no notice to me, you know. So I went up there. Anyway, I found out that this chap was interned, and he had a nice little couple of rooms upstairs, and he had lots of food. And he had meat, which was rare in Italy. And he cooked up some steaks for us, you see. And he explained, he used to go off and get tobacco in Leaf. And that's what his pack was full of, tobacco, and he knew where to go for it. Then he came back to the village, and then he traded the tobacco for goods in return from the local Italians. And so he was living quite well. He decided, and I found out what he did. He used to come from Ljubljana, and his civil profession was a tram driver.
Why did he want to team up with you?
He just felt that I was on the same side as him, you know, and he just wanted to be helpful, that's all. He had lots of courage when you think about it. Mm? And what I didn't know then, he had a son with him, and his son had decided to fight the Germans, and had acquired a rifle, and with a group of other young men they'd been fighting and as partisans against the Germans.
A group of Italians?
Italians and some Yugoslavs, yeah? And the Germans had attacked this group, and they'd shot and injured his son. But his son had laid low, and him and another Yugoslav had gone and rescued his son from out in the countryside and dragged him back in that village, and they'd hidden his son in another house in the village, and he was lying there wounded. So, you know, he was definitely, he didn't like the Germans. Yeah. So when I was in this house, another chap came there, and this other chap was an elderly man who had been a senator in the Yugoslav parliament.
Another Chetnik?
Yes, another Chetnik. Then later on, another young couple, as a married couple, came, and these were the two communists. One, he was always referred to as the doctor, and actually, in fact, he had a bookshop in Split, and his wife, in fact, was a doctor as well, but she was a medical doctor. He was a doctor of philosophy, I think. So there were definitely, he was a university man, yeah. And she was a doctor of medicine. But they were really serious communists, you know. But very nice people, you know.
What was their relationship with the Chetniks then? Was there any friction?
No, no, they were all intent. Of course, as you know, in later years there was, you know. But not at that time. They seemed to be working together with each other, you know. Anyway, I stayed in this house. Then all of a sudden, the German regiment... there was one night, all of a sudden, there was a lot of banging going on the door of our flat, and the Germans were wanting to get in the flat. What in point of fact they were doing, they were waking the warrant officer up. Hmm? I thought they were coming in to stay in there. And they got up, and the Germans paraded then in the village square, and they all left. So we now had nobody there. And so I said to you, so if the Germans have left, what's down the south now? He said, there won't be anything. So he said, let's go and look. So that day, him and I set forth a look, and we went down and kept, and we walked a few miles, and we met Indian troops. That's where the Germans had left, of course, isn't it? And so I met then, and then I found a subedar major and went up to the subedar major and told him how I was.
Did he seem suspicious?
Not a bit, no. And he asked me for any identity. I had a little letter from the Red Cross on me at the time, so I was able to give him that, didn't I? And then he got on to his headquarters, and the next thing was a truck appeared and picked me up, and I was took back to the battalion headquarters and met the colonel. And from then on, they started dispatching me homewards.
So that was December 43?
That's right, yeah.
Did you come across any Italian partisans on your trek south?
Only once met... when I was up further north, I once met a group of them, and they wanted me to go up. There's a mountain near Ascipatina called Monte di Fiore, which just means flower mountain, but it's a high mountain peak there. And they want me to go up there with them, because they said there was a partisan camp up there and they were going to join them up there. And I looked at this mountain and I couldn't see any point in going sitting on top of a mountain, so I declined. And I remember the next day afterwards, I could see shells bursting on top of the mountain. And I heard later on, of course, the Germans had gone up and got this lot and killed most of them.
How many of them were in this party?
There was only about four in this party. They were just going to join them.
Did they have any arms?
Yes, they had rifles.
A rifle each?
Mm-hmm.
Italian rifles?
They'd been Italian army soldiers.
Did they seem very soldierly?
Not particularly, but Italian soldiers never seem very soldierly to us, you know. You know, because they're never smart and highly disciplined like we are.
Now, in July 1941, whilst you were on passage to West Africa in a troopship called SS Anselm, you were sunk. Can you tell me the details about that, please?
Yes, I'd been posted overseas, of course, because when you were posted overseas, you never knew where you were going during the war. Nobody told you what your posting was, so all I'd done is gone to Liverpool and got on this ship, the Anselm. And then when we'd gone out under convoy into Liverpool Bay, the first thing that happened there, of course, is we were thrown out the convoy because the ship couldn't keep the convoy speed. The ship was only managing to do about 5.5 knots and the convoy speed was 7 knots. So we got told to leave the convoy. So we left the convoy and then went up into the Clyde and anchored off Greenock. And we stayed there a couple of days. And then we went off then in a sort of a private convoy. The ship was on its own, and we had an escort all of our own of three ships. There was a frigate called the Stalwart and another frigate, and then there was what was in point of fact a survey ship called the HMS Challenger, and they were our own private escort. Now, we set forth and we would travel for about 5 days. I had a very unpleasant time because I was seasick for 5 days. I've always been subject to sickness, both air sickness and seasickness. It's always, all my flying career I've had to contend with it. I always got seasick. If you show me a ship, I'll get sick. And Anyway, I had a very unpleasant time. And anyway, on this particular night, it was the first night where I'd felt that I could actually go down in the hole and sleep in this hammock I was supposed to sleep in. I'd sat up on the deck every night. The weather was terrible, but I couldn't go below because I felt so ill, you know. And my mates had fixed up a hammock for me, which is just near the companionway, the steps going down, you know. And so I got down and climbed my hammock that night, and I still had all my clothes on, my greatcoat and my life jacket. And I settled down in that, and I actually got to sleep for about the first time since I'd been on the ship. And then I was suddenly waking with this bloody violent explosion. You know, I had no doubt what it was. Of course, it was a torpedo. You know, and point of fact, we'd just been told that we were clear of the area of possible torpedo attack, and they'd start to relax some of the restrictions on what we could do, and also allowed to have the BBC service broadcast to us on the, you know, the loud hailer system they have on ships for public address, you know. And there's this large wallop and bang. And so I just rolled out of my hammock, and of course the whole place was full of smoke, and there was lots of crying and screaming and noise from all directions. And then I heard another bang, but that was farther aft of our position. We were in the forward hold of the ship, where all our lot were, and then farther back there was another hold filled with more troops farther back, and another torpedo had gone in that area. And there's only a couple of seconds between the two events. And so then I just, say, I rolled out of the hammock and just headed straight up the deck, because I was on the floor adjacent to the Lawson deck, and got straight out on the deck. And of course when I got there, there was lots of other people doing the same thing. And then from there I went up onto the what would be the promenade deck, because it was only a 7,000 ton ship. It's only really an old cargo boat, you know. It was a pretty grim ship, to be honest. And got there, and just about that time I saw a lot of people had actually jumped off the ship, I suppose in panic. The ship was still underway, and some of them had killed themselves, because with the old border trade life jackets, you had to hold them like this.
Hold them down?
Yeah, to stop them breaking your neck. And there were some of them floating down there, obviously suffering from that little problem, you know. In fact, one of the chaps I could see down in the water, I knew, a young lad, you know, and he was obviously quite dead. Don't know why he'd jumped, you know.
What was his name?
I don't know his name now. And then there was a lifeboat being lowered and people getting into it, and then I saw them lower this lifeboat, and as it went in the water, it just tipped over, because the ship, you don't lower lifeboats with I didn't know that personally then, but you don't lower boats while the ship's got way. And it just tipped over and shot everybody in the sea, you know. But that time I then remembered that when I'd first come on the ship, I'd been allocated a boat station, and my boat station was actually on the boat deck, and I was supposed to be lowering boats. Now, did I boat drills and things, you know, every day, but I'd never been to any because I'd been ill. Anyway, I thought, God. And so I went shooting up onto the boat deck then, and I got up onto the boat deck and went to where my station was, and there was only about three people there. Some of them, because they'd obviously been killed, you know. But there was the chief engineer there, and one seaman, and these other three people, and then I joined them. We set forth to lower this boat that we were supposed to lower then. And so we got this boat lowered, and then we lowered it down to the promenade deck, you know, because the seamen nip in and lower it from the falls, you know. And then that filled up with people, and we got that one down in the water. And then as we got that down in the water, the captain announced then that the ship would probably take about